Hey Osiris listeners, we want to tell you about our friends at Sunset Lake CBD who support this show. Sunset Lake CBD is a Vermont hemp farm crafting affordable CBD products designed to help with sleep and stress without breaking the bank. If you haven't tried CBD before, take it from me, it's a game changer. I use Sunset Lake's tincture every night before I go to bed, helping me get solid, restful sleep. And their gummies are great for daytime. Check out their new Good Vibes gummies, which have just a bit of hemp-derived THC to help you relax and unwind. Sunset Lake CBD crafts products with hemp grown on their family farm and ships them directly to customers. They have tinctures, salves, edibles, coffee, smokables, and even pet products. By the way, their CBD chocolate fudge is awesome. Check them out today at sunsetlakecbd.com and use coupon code TIME for 20% off all products. Sunset Lake CBD, farmer-owned, Vermont-grown.
Welcome back to the Comes a Time podcast. I'm Mike Fenoya.
And I'm Oteo Burbridge, and we've got the best one today. I know you thought, who are they going to do after Bob Weir? Someone who got on the bus before the Grateful Dead did, the empress of our whole scene, Carolyn Mountain Girl Garcia.
Yep, we had MG. We got her on a hot day on the farm. We told her, give the tomatoes a break and come talk to us. And boy, what a thrill. I mean, the fact that we're able to, you know, how full circle this all is and how we're able to chat with really the folks that got this whole thing started, it's just so unbelievable. And especially, you know, when we're all kind of locked up at home and we can't be together as the community. She shed a lot of amazing light on what we've been talking about this whole time, man, about a bit of being available to the moment. Pretty wild.
Yeah, she is so much fun to talk to. And I'm really glad that we weren't limited, you know, by a short time. I hate our whole soundbite culture, you know, and it's nice to just meander with someone. And God, you know, the living history that, you know, all of our guests represent is something to really be grateful for. And that's why we want to try to interview a lot of people while they're still here, regardless of their age, because none of us know how much time we have. But the memories in her head, man, that was just, and she's such a easy person to talk to and just really intelligent and funny. So we had some good laughs.
Yeah, we did. And you know, it's been a kind of a running theme in my life since I met Keezy to be, you know, I like talking to as many people that knew him that I can, because he changed my life in the way he changed a lot of people's lives. And, MG was there from the start, you know, took a lot of wild trips on that bus and kept the bus going, both literally and figuratively. So she's got a great line of products too that we would love for you guys to check out to support.
Yes, check out Mountain Girls Botanica. They have a collection of therapeutic herbal products, health products for well-being, brain fitness, and cognitive enhancement. Wow. So, yeah, go and check that out and support her and enjoy this fun ride that we took on this last podcast.
And stick around for a lot of very incredible guests and just Oteil and I on the Comes a Time podcast. We love you guys. Thank you so much for listening.
Comes a time when the blind your hands, don't you see?
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Comes a Time podcast. Hi, Oteil.
What's up, Mike? I'm so excited today.
We have the queen.
Is this really the first time you've done this?
No.
I didn't think so. I couldn't be.
It's Oteil's second or third.
Okay, good.
I'm an old grizzled veteran.
Indeed.
Okay. It's an honor to welcome and introduce to our listeners Carolyn MG Mountain Girl Adams Garcia. Everything.
Correct. That's it.
The it's such an absolute honor to be talking with you. And this is coming out to the listeners during the days between our holiday, our mm-hmm. I call it Deadhead Hanukkah, because it's eight crazy nights of celebrating Jerry's life.
Okay.
Just for the time, just for the calendar.
Right.
But thank you so much for joining us and mm-hmm. taking some time to chat.
Yeah, we're super happy to have you.
Well, it's 90 degrees outside here, so I'm really happy to be inside and sitting in a cool house. So,
yeah, how is
you're out on the farm, right?
I am out on the farm. I haven't been back to town except for doctor's appointments for the last almost 5 months now. And it's I'm getting used to it, and I'm actually starting to say, well, it looks like I've moved. And so I'm out here with my cat. And you know, it's a little lonesome, so I'm really glad you guys called.
Yeah.
Thank you.
You're welcome anytime. Is it just you and the cat?
Yeah, me and the cat.
Have you started to talk a lot, free, long verse to the cat like I do with my dog?
I actually sing to the cat now, but he's deaf, luckily, so he doesn't get too upset.
That's wonderful. Yeah. Oh, man. You know, MG, you and I met in 2001 at Horning's Hideout. I was in the Willamette Valley visiting Ken Kesey. I met him at a Phish concert in 97, and I asked if I could interview him for a senior project. Mm-hmm. He invited me out to his farm, and I lived with him at the farm, at the barn. And you and Barlow, I believe, called him and said, hey, we're up at Horning's Hideout for string cheese. Why don't you come up? And he wasn't feeling well. And he said, right. I'm going to send my guy up. And he threw me the keys to the pickup truck. And I met up with Zane and Jeb. Uh-huh. No, Simon Babs.
Yeah.
And we drove up and met up with you, and we hung out and watched their unbelievable show at Horning's Hideout.
And so that must have been string cheese.
Yes.
Oh boy, what fun! I mean, we had so much fun at Horning's Hideout, and I'm just wondering what they're doing there this year. Probably just a few little weddings. You know, it's just one of the more special venues I've ever been to. It kind of takes the cake, actually, for Pacific Northwest immersion.
And, it really, that band and the choreography of it all and the design, they really turned it into, you know, this kind of land that you would imagine in a children's book that lives underneath a mushroom where the
gnome- it is that's what I mean. It's like the quintessential Northwest setting, and to have a stage there and the little lake and the, you know, the trees are growing really, really fast. I was kind of shocked the last time I went up there was how big the all those giant fir trees have gotten. Wow. Since I first started going there, and I figured, oh, it's probably because the hippies are peeing on them at night. You know, and they're getting a lot of extra fertilizer, and they've like doubled or tripled in size in 15 years or so. It's kind of ridiculous. And then this beautiful evening that they have there, this long, soft evening light with the bands playing. It's just a special place.
It really is beautiful. And Oteil and I were talking about the, you know, that Kesey trip, me at 21 years old going out there and meeting my heroes. Ken was like the most unbelievably warm and welcoming person to me, a stranger from the Northeast. Yeah. And he picked me up at the bus station with a Ban the Bullet sticker on the side of his pickup truck. And I thought, how apropos 19 years later, we still need that sticker more than ever.
We need that sticker more than ever. It was, I mean, everybody kind of poo-pooed his concept at the time. That didn't seem very realistic, but it actually makes a great deal of sense. And, you know, it's easier to get a gun than it is to make a bullet. So if you had to make one, you wouldn't be shooting your gun off very often, you know. But he had a great idea. And he had a lot of great ideas. In fact, Ken Kesey was an idea factory that sort of never shut down. It's, I think he probably had more good ideas than anybody I've ever met. And of course, not all of them were essentially practical, but they were good. You know, he had such a sense of humor about making up stuff about what we could do. You know, so he was an inspiration to everybody that came to see him. Just like you said, he would somehow plug into whatever it is you were interested in and then throw in a whole bunch of ideas and get the conversation going at breakneck speed. He was so good at that. We miss him so much here. It's ridiculous. He left a horrendous vacuum, as did Jerry for that matter. You know, it's just like, dang. And yet people carry on. So Zane is still driving around with the bus. He goes to various events, especially, you know, I ran into him at the Hemp Fest in Seattle last year and had a great time hanging out with him there. But that bus is the second further, and it is just a beautiful thing. He has done a gorgeous job with that bus.
It's funny, when I was visiting in 2001, we came across the internet, the original, the 1939 Harvester that was in the backyard covered in moss.
Right.
And Ken and I were scraping moss off the side of the bus. And it seems like the nutrients in the moss almost gave the paint job a revitalization. So when he was scraping the moss off, he was seeing all these bright colors and I could see how excited he was getting. Mm-hmm. And it was one of those things that was very like, what the hell am I doing here? At the time, but now looking at it, it's like it was all supposed to happen. And I felt he knew I was a little bit green behind the ears and he was, you know, holding my hand through it. So it was just an unbelievable experience.
Well, it was very smart of you to go there. I think, you know, that's kind of what I did. Only I think I was 18 when I did that and showed up at Ken's place. And had the bus, the incredible flash of what the bus was. And in those days, it was still pretty fresh and didn't have moss on it yet. But the poor old bus, it's kind of rusted out now. And there's not a lot of paint left on it, but it's still in the bus barn where it belonged. They pulled it up out of the swamp a few years ago and put it in the bus barn. So, but it's looking kind of fragile actually right now. So jeez. I'm afraid it's rusting out.
It's from the 40s, isn't it? That bus?
1939, I think it was. Yeah, 1939, and it had a big early adolescence as a school bus. So it got, you know, and then it was the prankster bus we took it all the way to southern Mexico and banged around, and I mean, and you know, it had the worst shifting. It's something called compound shifting, which they used to have before there was automatic transmissions. And it's like this super complex little dance you have to do with the big shift lever on the floor, which had a sort of like a little pull-up thing and a this, and it had to go like this and this and this. I could never figure it out myself. So it took a special person who had grown up running farm equipment to actually shift the bus and get it to go. And so anybody who'd had experience with old tractors and combines and hay balers and all that kind of stuff didn't have that much trouble with it. But what a
is that
dog.
Why Neil Cassidy looked like he was always dancing around up there?
Oh yeah. Well, that was Neil. Neil was dancing wherever he was. It didn't, you know, he often, you know, he sort of drove the bus by magic, I thought, you know, because he often just didn't touch the wheel. You know, he just would take his hands off the wheel and he'd be playing his flute. How did we ever stay alive? I don't know.
It is.
So when you went down to Mexico, was that when you guys were on the run from the police?
We were indeed. I had gotten out on bail after our bust on the rooftop, but Ken skipped. And he was supposed to go in, and he ran. So, God, it's a long story, all of that, and it seems so long ago now, and so colossally kind of dumb. But you know, to get all these agencies looking for you, that's not a really smart thing to do. You want to figure out a better deal for yourself.
Yeah. Plus, anyway, a gigantic waste of money too on their part.
It was very expensive, yeah. So When was this? So this was right after the TRIPS Festival in San Francisco. And the TRIPS Festival was really pretty much the first event of its kind that was 100% electric, to say the least. And it was just wild. And it was a collaboration of a number of different little, you know, weirdo groups who had instruments or had interesting sound generating equipment or light shows and all this stuff. So we didn't even know most of the folks that were performing there. But as a prankster, I spent my entire time gathering up the film that wasn't spooling properly on our projector. So, every time I turned around, there'd be more film all over the floor and I'd have to go hand wind it up. So I missed a lot of the show because we were doing the projections. And got to, lean over the railing and see what was going on.
Wow.
And definitely a tremendous amount of action down there on the floor. But that was the end of our stint in San Francisco. We left very shortly thereafter for Points South and kept going.
Mm. That's when you did your cross-country trip.
I missed the cross country trip. I came onto the prankster crew the day I met them the day after they got back from that trip.
Ah, I got you.
And Neil Cassidy had been out and about in Palo Alto, scoring some weed and running into his old friends and he picked me up at the coffee shop. Because I was sitting there all grumpy, and he came over and chatted me up. And I thought, oh, this is more fun than me sitting here all grumpy. And so they said, yeah, come on, we'll take you. We'll go for a ride. We got to go up to so-and-so's house to score something, And I got in the car with these guys, and the car was like this nice white Ford station wagon. And it had this weird insignia on the door. And I'm looking at Neil, who was like such a character, and I'm thinking, what am I doing? And I'm looking at the insignia on the door of the car, and I'm going, well, what does that mean? It is. ITIS. And he says, oh, that's a church group. and it wasn't. It was the prankster insignia for Intrepid Travelers Information Service or something like that. So, amazing. So I thought, oh, that'll be safe. It's a church group,
I wonder how many people he used that line on. It's a church group. Get in.
It worked. I got in, and by 4 o'clock in the morning, we were pulling into to Kesey's yard, and there was the bus. And I swooned. I was so taken with the bus, I just felt it all over. It was so incredibly encrusted with paint and stuff. And oh, it was just wonderful. Just wonderful.
As a kid growing up with my dad's and my uncle's records and staring at every single album cover and trying to, dive into the world that, it had in it, the Grateful Dead was the first band that really kind of spoke to me on a level that was beyond anything else. And I, at 9, 10 years old, had pictures of, Jerry and everybody up on my wall and a picture of the bus. And then I went to a Phish concert in 1997 and there comes the bus, and Kesey and the guys hopped out. And that's when I first met him. And I was 17 and I went running over to the bus. And it just like you said,
when you
physically first see that thing, you're like,
it's a shock.
It really,
it's so wonderful and yet so completely unsafe looking. It's like, a school bus is a representation of safety, right? And then you see it like that and it's like, oh my goodness.
Cosmic safety.
Yes.
For sure.
Yeah, it's like the Starship Enterprise, but
it's
not nearly as safe.
If it was hand painted, like that. But we always, whenever we got together, we would always have, spend a little time working on the edges of the paint, and doodling and adding a few little things here and there. So it's still a work in progress, frankly. This but Further 2 is absolutely fabulously beautiful. Zane's bus, Zane Kesey's bus.
Yeah.
And it's a brilliant work. He's done a gorgeous job with that bus. And it's really set up more for comfort and people with carpeting and stuff. Old Further, no. It's like wooden bunks. And, you know, it's just kind of horrible. But this one's very beautiful. And it's a 1945 or something like that. So it's a little newer, slightly.
Wow. You upgraded to 45.
You know, Oteil and I have had conversations about it just as early as today about, you know, Kesey and Jerry and the group that you guys sort of all formed together and got this scene. You know, obviously the scene goes back to prehistoric times, but I mean the scene, our leg of it, you guys kind of got kicking into high gear, and we owe you a debt of gratitude, and it's amazing that we're all here today to be able to talk about it. And it just, we're both kind of like so awe-inspired by the message of that Kesey had of just kind of being the star of your own movie and going for it, and about bringing peace and kindness to the, you know, through humor and through kind of self, you know, killing the ego.
Indeed. And also being available to people as he made himself available to you. He would do that with people, new people that he met that he thought would be receptive to whatever thoughts he was having that day. So, you know, he was a really open person to newness and new people, which made him a gateway drug all by himself.
I love that about it, because I watched him talking about that. Like he said, you know, my books are not my greatest accomplishment. Like, the bus is, and making now, like being involved in now, this perpetuating thing is the greatest accomplishment, and that everybody can join in that, you know. And it's amazing to me that it was seen as so subversive and extremist, and you know, it's just like everybody's getting together painting this bus and just like we're just going our own way. And now we have FBI files, and the other irony to me, and that's one thing I wanted to ask you about, was that the government's the one that started all this. I mean, they created the asset and gave it to the military and then gave it to people at the college. And now you're all mad because you couldn't control it. And now it's like, you know, you clamped down. I wonder, it must have been such a weird thing to go through.
Well, you know, basically I personally didn't know the story till much later, you know, about how LSD came to be part of the government's secret program and all that. So a lot of that information was just buried. Ken found out about it fairly early, but not the way you think. I mean, he was working at the asylum as a night watch guy. You know, looking after the people who were locked up there, the real nuts, and he happened onto a part of that building which had been locked up for years, where the MK Ultra stuff had been going on, and then we met a couple of people who knew about that, and the story started to gel. You know, suddenly we realized, wait, there's a continuum here. And I think that, you know, if you're an inquisitive person, once you've dabbled here, you're going to be interested in it for a long time, because there's really no end to the human imagination. And I didn't really know much, but I was very pleased when I got into psychedelics. I thought they were pretty wonderful.
I think they're like for people that have not had mystical experiences or religious experiences, quote unquote, which I have had since I was very young. And even with having mystical experiences and quote unquote religious experiences, you know, psychedelics was definitely like a tangible extreme benefit. You know, if you don't go too far, like the way we did it, we were always doing like half a hit. We just talk.
Yes, that's what I think. That's exactly right. I think don't go too far. You know, just start small. You know, definitely, because too much is easily attained, and too much can really drag you down in the long run. So, having done that myself a couple of times, I'm pretty much I would call myself a lightweight at this point with psychedelics. So. Well, but you know, and sometimes they're very inconvenient, and I think people have used them badly, often in the past, and to their own detriment. But carefully, and that's just where it's got to be.
I don't think Western culture really had as much of a tradition like, say, Native Americans with peyote and different cultures around.
No, we didn't have a ceremony, and we still really don't. You know, I think people are making their own ceremonies now, and I don't even know what's going on, really. We can't know, because the world is such a big and heavily populated place. We can't know everybody, and or how it's being used these days, but I would assume it's pretty much the same way we were, which was to, you know, enlighten and and enliven, you know, it makes you more lively.
Yeah. I mean, I took a month in the winter and did a micro dosing month where I took a small amount of mushrooms every couple days.
Mm-hmm.
And the rule of thumb was, if you felt it, you took too much. It was kind of more for tomorrow you were taking it. And I definitely had a couple of soft, soggy moments where, you know, I would break down in tears at a Rite Aid in the middle of Queens, but, you know, it was a good cry.
Understood. No, and you don't know when it's going to touch, you don't know how that's going to touch you, you know, if you're out at the pharmacy at the middle of the night, you could have a little meltdown. So yeah, wisdom slowly enters the mind, and you begin to learn how to manage that.
Yes. And it's what, like, just like what you said about just being available and being, you know, I think with trying to perform and trying to live a, you know, compassionate life and balance everything, you start to bog down. And I think that critic starts to get a little chattery. And I think that the best thing that the psychedelics do on a micro level is it just kind of turns down the volume and, well, it rolls up the windows a little bit and just lets you kind of be present in yourself. And that to me is if it can just do that, I'm all for it forever. And I think about the folks like us who have been to that other realm, seen that other dimension, and then you see the ego-driven world, it makes you sad. It makes you really think, wow, it's sad that everyone can't realize that we're all the same species and we're all the same people and we're all here. You know, I think that the world can use a nice dose right about now.
Right. The world's having some problems right now. And I don't know if people are ready for right now we have this other issue going on, and it kind of has taken precedence over everything. And so who knew the world was going to suddenly change, you know, like it just did. And, you know, in a certain way, the discovery of psychedelics for a lot of people was a similar global shift, although not quite to the degree that COVID virus is. So, you know, we're learning new behaviors. We're entering into another phase of human development, which is a little bit mysterious right now. We don't really know how this is all going to play out. And, if we're going to be stuck with this stuff forever. So, you know, I'm on the side of the pharmacologists who are working their asses off to get a vaccine for this thing. And I'm just praying for that vaccine, please. I don't want to get this virus. I don't want anybody else to get it, but here we are in a crisis situation. And, frankly, I haven't really gone to psychedelics for any answers about this. I think
you're on the right route, kind of going back to nature, because I think that's the original psychedelic experience, the original religious experience. And if people, you know, can get back to like just embracing that simplicity, I think, I know it's hard for people if you live in an apartment in New York, but you know, where you are on the farm, it's got to be great to just like, you know.
Well, I'm isolating myself for a reason. You know, this is like, this wasn't my first choice for what I was going to do this summer. I thought I was going to go to a bunch of great shows and have a blast, right?
Amen. Amen to that.
Dang.
It's painful.
I'm still mad about it. You know, it's like, oh, rats, we could be having some, and I look at the list of stuff we aren't going to, you know, that aren't happening. It's like,
I had to erase my calendar because, like, every day was showing me what we're going to have a day off here. We're going to be playing here tomorrow. And I was just like, okay.
Getting emails that concerts are canceled and festivals are canceled.
Yeah. You think about the collapsing of our whole economic pyramid, you know, for the promoters and all of the people that work for them and the venues and everything. It's just it's colossal. And, you know, I'm not sure how we're going to, let's just hope for the best.
Well, and MG, to stick with that, you know, Oteil and I kind of have talked a bunch about how he's turned to comedy many times for balance as a musician. I turned to music as a comedian for balance. The one time I can just turn off is at concerts. And I think about, and I go back and watch, you know, the show from the Creamery in 72.
Oh, yeah.
And I look at some of them. I mean, when you think about those moments and you go back to those places, you know, I mean, just what was the feeling like when you were, when it was all happening? Like I try to send my,
that's easy. I was ecstatic. You know, I was dancing in a circle, you know, was really pretty much what it was. And then fielding a lot of people's interest as well, so you know, meeting new people and so on. But I loved the music so much and the energy that it generated. It was just a vortex of joy for me that I could just step into and it was just great. Those early shows had a special feel because they seemed so radical. They were radical acts. You know, they were full of some kind of weird left-handed kindness, you know, where we were dishing out this really loud, raspy, not very great sound at first, you know, which got better and better as time went on until it became transcendental, you know, and it became a transcendental experience instead of just sort of a lot of R&B and noise and dance music. It all began to shift into this other, another plane. And I mean, what a ride, you know, really incredible. I think my mom and dad weren't real happy with it, but
makes it good.
These were incredibly special days, and we kind of knew it. You know, we knew the band knew perfectly well that they had broken through to another plane of existence. You know, the world had shifted, and they became acceptable. That was amazing.
That's crazy.
It's pretty wild how that music has given me, at least, and I'll only speak for myself, but I'm sure millions of others, a place to go mentally, transcendentally, like you said, where when I'm stuck in a, you know, room because my surroundings are, you know, COVID and all this, but I can go. All I need is my headphones, and it's like I'm visiting an old friend, you know, and it's really sad, but it's also, it makes you realize how important the music really is and how deep of a, it's not just a two-dimensional thing. I mean, it brings on dimensions of such depth.
That's what makes it so hard for us because, you know, our community, like the jam band community, there's nothing without the live thing. You know, and you've got to be together.
But, you know, if you remember the lonely saxophone player in the subway tunnels in New York, you know, there's still room. There's still room for those expressions. But we're just not going to have the big events yet for a while. But I think the one or two people together can do a lot to raise the spirits of people.
Well, that's what we're trying to do with this.
That's why we're here.
To connect.
Well, this isn't exactly music, but I guess.
Well, just wait. We haven't gotten to the musical part yet. We're going
Okay.
We're all going to sing a song.
But... Ooh. Okay.
Were you was Kerouac the one that kind of was on the road, the thing that got you on the road?
No, I thought that book didn't gel for me. I couldn't quite figure out what it was all about. So no, and I hadn't even heard of Kerouac before I met these guys. So yeah, Cassidy would talk about Kerouac, and I was just going, I'm gonna have to get a copy of that book and see what it's all about. But all that stuff is still living, you know. A couple of the pranksters have turned it into a little show that they do where they go and act out. The parts of Jack and Neil talking in you know, it was, it's pretty wild.
Yeah.
And so they actually did a little tour last year and went around and spoke at a number of different book festivals around the States and had a lot of fun being Jack and Neil for, you know, 20, 30 minutes a day. That's great. And they just kind of make it up as they go along. They kind of got, you know, they're not reading lines. They're extemporizing, and it worked well, and people loved it. And it reminds you that a conversation doesn't have to make sense. You know, it doesn't have to do that thing. It doesn't have to relay some kind of specific knowledge. It can just be a conversation, and it can go anywhere.
You, Oteil, we were talking about how MG had the like just the amazing honor to be like among so many unbelievable people, you know. Jerry, we obviously had to ask about hanging out, getting to know Garcia, being around another idea guy. How magical was those early days, the Golden Gate Park stuff, the hanging out, just getting to know Jerry as a person? Was it just like lightning right away? I mean, everything you hear is just, he's just such a force that everyone would be drawn to.
I actually didn't notice Jerry for quite a while because they were so deeply engaged with each other, trying to make their music fit together, because none of them were like really qualified professional musicians when we first met them. They were a bunch of teenagers and hangout dudes with guitars. And, I think Kreutzmann was probably and Phil were the only two seriously studious musicians at that time. Jerry played banjo, you know, he hadn't really played much guitar. And they were just the band there for the first few months. And it took a while because they would come in, set up, play their set and go home. They didn't really hang out and be part of the prankster weirdness that I was part of. And it wasn't until we came back from Mexico that Jerry and I hooked up. But during that whole period, you know, I was pregnant. I had a baby in a funky Mexican hospital, and I was having a huge adventure of my own. It was pretty wild. But we were also, all of us, the whole scene, completely broke. We had no money. I mean, it was trying to get gas money was, you know, pulling pennies out of your pockets. So, I remember seeing the pre-band gig at Kepler's bookstore, at the top of the Tangent in Palo Alto. I was working in Palo Alto at that time, and I was riding my bicycle down the street, and I heard this wonderful music, and the place was just going whoa like that. And this was pre-pranksters, before I'd met anybody in Palo Alto. Wow. And there was the whole gang, everybody that worked in the Grateful Dead office later, plus Jerry and Pigpen and Weir, who was, I think, was Weir's playing the the washtub bass at the time. And I think, you know, it was so it was the people who became the crew, and it was so much fun. And that's a recording that you can get. It was, they did a...
Oh, was that Mother McCree's Jug Band?
Mother McCree's.
Yes, Mother McCree's. Yes. Okay. And it was one of their early gigs, and it was hilarious beyond belief. And, you know, I go, wow, these guys are really, really amazing. But they're all very clean cut at the time. You know, everybody had straight jobs. And I think Jerry had just dropped out of the Army. You know, I have no idea. I never met any of them at that time. It took a long time to find a way to meet them. So
I really do wish there was more out there about Pig. I wish there Indeed. Was. I mean, he seemed like such a deep, sweet person, and so like an old soul kind of. And you know, when the dead trailed more towards those longer jams, and maybe Tom Constison would sit in, and other things like then, where Pig would sort of not be in the front all the time, it seemed sad a little bit.
Well, he was the front man, you know, for a number of years. And he would come out and do those long, fabulous blues tunes, you know, and add a lot of repartee to it. And, you know, he was a very creative, but his history, you know, his personal life history, his dad was a DJ, a blues DJ over in the East Bay. And so he grew up hearing all this stuff, you know, Lightning Hopkins and, you know, B.B. King. And he knew the material intimately. And so he could step in and carry a show when everybody else was taking a little break, or, you know, couldn't think of what to play next or whatever. He always had something ready to go. And as the front man, which means the guy that gets out in front and actually does a lot of the heavy singing, he performed beautifully, but his health wasn't good. And, you know, he suffered from bad health from the day, I think, as soon as we knew him. But he was such a unique character. Oh my God, he was like nobody you'd ever meet before. He was completely himself. You know, he was not concerned about what other people thought about him. And, you know, it was almost an impenetrable exterior. You couldn't quite figure out who he was behind the long curly hair and the weird bearskin jacket and the, you know, he just was... He was a unique guy, and he will always be missed in our scene. And I don't think anybody that was on tour with him understood just how ill he was in the last couple of years of his life. And they just toured on and didn't realize that Pigpen was just kind of not doing well. But he had the repertoire of songs. He could pull it out. Boom, you know, just, and not only the song, but all of the jive. He could do all the jive. He was so good at it. And I feel like he's just like a lost treasure at this point.
Yeah. But it's really great. You know, I think about all of you, it seems like that's the religion of the whole thing, is like to be your actual authentic self. Like you have to almost let yourself be yourself to find out what that is, you know.
And musically, that's I think that's really important for musicians. They need to play what they want to play. That's when their full heart and soul gets into the music.
Yeah.
And you know, I've been to so many shows, you know, where things didn't work, you know, the mics weren't working right. Somebody was getting bit on the lip by the hot mics, and you know, it's like, you know, and then it would just like, ah, and then, you know, 20 minutes would go by and suddenly everything was okay. And it would just blossom, you know, like a huge cloud of happy musicians working together. So to be able to survive the tough moments without quitting or starting to chew each other out for stuff, that they did a lot of that. They managed to keep going when Jerry had broken two strings, you know, he could still play, and he would.
Well, it feels like it spilled off stage too. Like that's what everybody was doing. Like, you know, when I think of the pranksters that weren't musicians, you know, it was
most of us.
But that was the music.
It's the Thunder Machine. You could play the Thunder Machine.
Yeah.
It was like the bus was the instrument, and the your lives were the music, you know? And I feel like that's what was so subversive and what was so revolutionary about it and threatening to the establishment. It's like, yeah, wow, it shouldn't be that threatening, you know, but it was, and apparently still is, you know.
And also so freeing to the ones that got it, though. I mean, it was like, oh, someone else thinks like I do.
Yeah, right. So, you know, the Thunder Machine, for folks who never saw a picture of it, was parts of old car fenders welded together by an artist friend of ours, Ron Boise, who was a really good metal sculptor.
I got to play it.
And it's, you know, and then we, you know, it was this big, weird thing that, you know, like 6 feet tall with a lot of, and then Kesey would put strings on it that you could actually tune, sort of. And it was basically meant to be hammered on by a lot of kindergarten kids. And so adults really liked it too. But, you know, and then painting it was really fun too, because it was these weird shapes. It didn't, you know, it didn't amount to anything. Somebody finally put wheels on it toward the end, and that helped a lot because it was a heavy sucker. But you could just wheel it out into a parking lot, and people would just, boom, you know, what is that? What are you doing? You know, it had these big, thick, heavy bass strings on it, so it would kaboom, you know, when you pull a string. And so people were completely charmed, not just by the machine itself, but by the thought, you know, that you could just make some dumb, crazy-looking thing like that. And it was fun, you know, because it was so much about fun. The pranksters had a lock on the fun things. They really pursued the fun trip.
Hey there, Osiris listeners. I wanted to tell you about our friends over at Smart Wool. For more than 25 years, Smart Wool has been making merino wool socks and apparel designed to keep you comfortable. Because they want to help you play, laugh, and explore in the outdoors with every thread they knit and every step you take. Because they believe that comfort sharpens focus and lets you perform beyond your limits. They are here to help you feel good. Now, it's up to you how far you will go. Take 15% off of your first order at smartwool.com. Smart Wool. Go far, feel good.
You know, listening to the Grateful Dead is like listening to five different bands, because you've got all those eras and you've got all those different time periods and members, but also it's also a lesson in life. And like you were saying, Oteil, you know, like it spills off into the crowd. If you study and really get into the mindset, they weren't thinking about success. They weren't thinking about fame. They were thinking about fun, and they were thinking about, you know, the music was serious, but they were thinking about just how do we keep satisfying our own, you know, goals, which that seems to me to be something that is freeing, you know, from a comic standpoint. I'm just like, yeah, I just want to speak from as purely as possible and just be happy with what I have to say, and hopefully other people dig it. And it's fun to live like that, because the Dead kind of created the foundation, and the Pranksters. And that's what I love so much about Kesey. He put me at ease. I was 21 years old. I had never left my home.
Understood. Yeah.
And he, right away, he picked me up and he goes, "You're one of those cigarette smoking, beer drinking New Englanders, huh?" And I was like, "Yeah." And he's like, "I like that." And right away I was like, "Oh, cool. He likes me." And when we watched Jaws and we cooked and we had such a good time. I helped him tie-dye dip the Search of a Cool Place videos that he was selling. And
right.
I worked with him and Babs and it was right away I was a part of the family. And like you had said earlier, I feel like they knew the people that they knew were going to get it, got it, you know, and that's important.
Misfits find each other.
Yes.
Thankfully.
Yes. And Kesey was very exceptional. He had a lot of room in that brain of his for new faces. And he knew how to incorporate your energy into what he was doing, and, you know, and do that quite easily and quickly. He was able to just reach over there and get your attention and get you to do the stuff he was doing, you know, working on those tapes and dip painting and doing all this little stuff. And it made him a lot more fun for him. He had somebody to bounce off of. So somebody new that hadn't heard all this stuff before, you know? And so I think you were game. And that was, being game is a big part of this. If you're not ready, or if you're feeling the big backup coming, oh, I got to get out of here because this is just too weird, go away, you know, if you encounter these kinds of people. But if you're ready, this is enlightening stuff. So you
sure was.
You did the right thing.
Sure was.
Yeah.
This was like pre-9/11, so I was able to, I think statute of limitations is some marijuana may or may not have made it on me. Ooh. To the plane, you know, and as a gift. Yes. To him. Ooh. And we tried some, and he was like, this is nice, but I'm not really, do you mind if we try some of mine? And I was, whew, you know, already there. And he opened up a drawer, and some Green Angels were like, you'd hear like harps and,
oh yeah.
And we smoked, and I was outside, laying in his yard playing with the peacocks. He had about 1 million peacock in his yard.
Yes.
I was, he started talking to me about all these old, when he first met Bob Dylan, and Dylan had his head wrapped up and he was nervous to meet Kesey, and Kesey
was
excited to meet him and all these stories. And then Ken stops and goes, do you have your tape recorder going? And I'm like, no. And he goes, this is some pretty good shit. You might want to get your tape recorded.
So yeah, I run
and I'm all high and I'm trying to find, oh God. And it was just, man, it was hilarious.
You're making a very good point that running all that gear when you're high suddenly seems like the hardest thing you've ever done in your life.
it was terrifying.
God. You know, first your vision's a little off and you can't really remember where you put anything. And so it's a huge challenge. Sounds like you successfully navigated that particular waterfall.
I was like, am I holding this too close to his face? Am I holding it too far? Should I, right. Am I rude? Yeah. But he couldn't have been kinder. All of them.
Do you still have those tapes?
As a matter of fact, I do. And I released so the interview that I did was in his white pickup truck, and we were driving around Willamette Valley. I hope I'm saying that right. Willamette Valley. And he had jazz on and he had the window down and he was eating peanuts while talking. So I'm sitting in the passenger side. I'm almost kind of sitting in the middle. It was like one of those bench seat, you know, in the truck.
Yeah.
And I have the tape recorder kind of under his mouth and he's talking, but he's spitting peanut shells out the window and they're bouncing off the back window and flying at me. So I'm kind of dodging peanut shells. And so the tape was a little bit iffy. I got back to school and he died in November, and I sat in the basement at the library of my college and I transcribed all of it by hand and then typed it up and put it in Relics magazine where it was published. And then the tape sat for a while. And then finally, when you can digitize them and put them on an actual MP3, you know, a computer file.
Get them out there.
I did that and I scrubbed them and they sound much cleaner. We sound like we're sitting in a dryer, like in a clothes dryer, but it still is very audible. So we were able to, you know, I released one tape of it that where we go through basically the history of music going back from Billie Holiday all the way to the Stones and the Beatles and going to see the Beatles with the Dead and all of it. And, but I have the tapes and it's really, I have an hour tape of us in the barn playing the Thunder Machine and the theremin and the axophone and all the different instruments. So I'd be happy to share them with you if you'd like to hear them for sure.
Of course I would. Are you kidding? Yeah. I don't have enough of that stuff.
It'd be an honor. It would be an honor.
A lot of his stuff has gone to the, you know, to the various archivists and stuff like that. So I don't really have access to a lot of that stuff anymore. So it's always fun to get a new one. Yeah.
We want to make a pilgrimage up to see you too.
Yes.
In Oregon.
Oh,
and Mike.
Wear your white robes, you know, just walk all the way for sure. Make a pilgrimage. No, whenever that is, whenever we can travel again, we're hoping that's soon.
Yeah.
Real soon.
One thing that we were chatting about that we wanted to ask you was, you know, you're someone who, you know, I'm a road warrior comic that performs when I could. O'Teal touring like crazy.
Mm-hmm.
I thank my wife as often as I possibly can for putting up with the lifestyle that my proposal should have been, now's your chance to leave. But, you know, you're someone who had always, you're very industrious. You've got your own projects. You're not a tag along by any stretch of the imagination. Was it hard to you know, as a wife, as a fan, as a woman of your own, like to be able to say, I'm not going on this tour. I'm going to live my own life, do my own thing. Was that?
Well, you got to remember, we had three kids. So it was like, sometimes it was just impossible. And you just, it didn't work. It didn't work to take three kids on the road. It didn't really work well for me to be gone from home for more than a week. So I would go, but just for very short periods of time. My main responsibility and my personal programming shifted when I became a mom. And I wasn't going to the parties. There was a lot of parties without me. And I would hear about these parties and go, I really could use a good party, you know. And it was okay. Here's the deal. People would say, "Well, why don't you just get a babysitter?" Well, hello, we were too weird for any babysitter, and not only that, any babysitter that was weird enough for us wanted to be at the show. They didn't want to be at my house watching my kids. So it was very difficult to get a reliable or anybody really, frankly, to watch the kids that was even remotely trustworthy. So, you know, there was a lot of issues that go around having a family when one of the family members is out on the road, and you kind of have to just let go. And so I became very good at letting go and letting go of being out on the bus touring, letting go of being at the shows, really letting go of the whole mechanism of how the Grateful Dead operated too, because I wasn't part of the crew. So I didn't get to go to the meetings, the crew meetings, or hear really what was really going on. So I wasn't real happy about that, but it made life livable. And we have three wonderful daughters.
You absolutely do.
I was going to say, your daughters certainly appreciate it.
Yeah. And I think they do. I don't think they really remember that I had to skip an awful lot of fun to.
Yeah, but now that they're older, I'm sure they can appreciate more, especially, you know.
It's a different time now, and they're, you know, they're, it's been a lot of times gone by, lots of water under the bridge there. It's scary to think about how much time has gone by and that all of this stuff is still a big deal. You know, the whole Grateful Dead caravan into life, you know, how everybody jumped on. So many people jumped onto our bus. It was just incredible.
And that kind of brings me to what I wanted to ask you about mostly, which is, you know, when you say it's like everything, it's amazing, everything is such a big deal. I feel it's still such a big deal. I kind of feel like that on the other side of the coin, on the negative side of the coin, like, you know, we're still struggling with these same old issues that the movement that we had back then when you were participating in it the first time. And I wonder that's what I wanted to ask you about. Like, how does today's movement make you feel? Like, do you see us making certain mistakes that you made, or do you feel positive about where it's going? Or do you feel like, geez, I can't believe in the 21st century we're still like dealing with this, you know?
Well, I don't know. I actually think one of the big facts is that the population has gone up so drastically that even a small enterprise can succeed if it advertises itself well, you know? Mm-hmm. So I honor all the success that the whole Grateful Dead scene has had. I mean, it's astounding, really, considering the kooky guys that I used to know. You know, it's like, but I don't know how to answer your question, Otil, because it's all been sort of magical. You know, the quickness of connections that people suddenly make to you and to your life, and you know, you, Otil, you've now experienced, you know, what it's like to come into the Grateful Dead world and become somebody that people recognize. You know, while you're ordering an English muffin, you know, five people are lining up behind you wanting to get your autograph and take your fucking picture. Pardon my French. No, but it's like, it's hard to have, you know, it's so the public, private, on stage things, it's like three different worlds.
And I guess I was talking about probably more in terms of like the protests that are going on right now.
Oh, civil this rights stuff,
movement,
you know,
back then versus the movement that's happening now. I've always wondered the movement what you think that, of that, you know?
The movement that's happening now puzzles me. I'm not sure what's going on, except that people are frustrated and upset, and it's hot, and they're broke or whatever. I don't get it.
Quarantined.
Because it's not, so far, it hasn't been particularly productive. And I would hope that a lot of people would get together in somebody's garage and start building a boat or something. You know, get a project. Get a project going. I don't think being out in the street duking it out with a bunch of cops is productive work.
Especially, did you experience a lot of that back then? I mean, you had to see some of that going on.
We saw, well, yes, we did. And it was something to run away from for me. I did not want to be part of it. Because you don't know what's coming when you're in that situation. You're the back of your head. You can't see out the back of your head. Yeah. And it's an invitation to get injured and to lose your shit out there. And I it's so dangerous.
It is, for sure.
I think there's a lot of anger, though, and I have to admit, I don't quite understand what's going on.
Well, I think at first, when I look back at the old civil rights movement, it was super organized.
Yes.
Like, without internet, it's just unbelievable. And a lot of that was done through the churches.
Yeah.
And then they linked up with schools, like you see with John Lewis, you know, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating
Committee.
But then it was all hooked up to these churches. But the thing that
Stokely Carmichael, he was like incredibly gifted speaker. Oh yeah. My God, could he get an audience going?
Yeah.
So these
but then
people
I thought,
were...
well, you know, the thing that puzzled me about what's going on now is that it always seems so decentralized.
Yes.
Which I thought is probably, I guess I was looking at that as kind of a detrimental thing at first, but kind of withholding judgment, like, let's see what happens, because it's all kind of anarchy in a way, you know. But now I'd kind of changed my mind, because I'm like, well, somehow, even though it's decentralized and there doesn't seem to be the organization that we had before, it somehow grew into the biggest civil rights movement in history. And then we did get all these things changed, like, you know, no knock warrants are gone in Kentucky, and there's police departments being busted down to the studs and rebuilt, you know, and different things that are happening that I feel like are definitely happening because of the protests. But
here's the deal, Otil. We're not getting those stories here. I mean, I live in Oregon, and I only have three news channels out here in the country, but honest to God, the positive aspects of this are not making it into the national news here.
Interesting. Yeah.
And
funny,
so
I really do think like the revolution is somewhat for better and worse. Certainly we can see for worse, but also for better, like on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram. Like I don't watch mainstream, I call it corporate media anymore, because I don't feel like it's really giving me a full picture. But I also, like, I only use Twitter for news. They're just like alternative news sites, which will deal with the corporate reporting and what was left out or what's just a lie or whatever, you know.
Right.
So I'm not missing out on what the corporate news is saying, but I'm getting the fuller picture.
Good.
And a lot of these things are up to the minute. I mean, some things are live. You're watching it while it's happening live, you know. And that part, maybe I kind of answered my own question, is how it grew into such a globally huge thing without being organized because of that, you know. So it's amazing the things that you do see on there, like day to day, like stuff, a lot of things have gotten done just since George Floyd's murder that I'm like, wow, I think more things happen since then than the last 12 years.
I think that the pulling down of the statues was an awesome act of courage. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry for the artists because some of that stuff was really nicely done. You know, people paid pennies to have those things built. But they all need to go somewhere to the sculptured graveyard. But
or to a museum.
I think the part that the part that disturbs me the most is the active anger part. And it happens in the confrontations. And it's very difficult to keep that up. It's not good for you. And everybody needs to reach out and try to find some positive aspects of this, you know.
Yeah.
It's important to find the positive.
That's why it's sad we can't have the music, because that could be quarantine.
Yeah. That's what I was going to say. Yeah, it's right now we're at a time when, and folks like us who come from this world and this scene, that when we're together and you look across the aisle and you see someone that you've never met sweating and dancing and smiling and tears pouring, you feel that like we're connected. You're another, and that is something that I swear to God, I think I texted you, Oteil, when I was watching the Fare Thee Well repeat. The minute I go to my first concert, my head's gonna explode. Like, I'm really so in.
I know.
Just see, you know, the shakedown, going through the parking lot, seeing people being resourceful and friendly and feeding each other and hugging each other, and that's the thing that has fed, and that's where from our scene, you hope that some of that might be able to trickle into.
I have to agree with you totally about that, because that whole coming into a show that hasn't started yet, and the joy that you and I would immediately start to feel, it start bubbling up and you're getting all excited.
I'm getting goosebumps now.
People that haven't had that experience don't have it. When they follow you through the crowd, they're more nervous. Like, where's my seat? I can't find my girlfriend. Like, you know, blah blah blah. I'm gonna get my pocket's gonna get picked. Whatever. There's so many different levels of experience and expertise of navigating an event. I've almost lost my mind sometimes trying to get into events when, you know, oh no, it's at gate A. No, you have to walk around to gate E. Oh no, gate E's closed. Sorry, you got to go back to gate G, you know, whatever it is. And all you want to do is get in, you know, the supreme frustration of being shuttled around at shows when you're not part of the audience and you have a special pass. What pass is that? I have never seen a pass like that before. You know, so I've had that happen so many times to the point where I'm in tears, you know, you're all the way into the middle of the first set before you even can set foot inside the stadium because security is so heavy.
Yeah.
And so we've all gotten so used to managing security that there didn't used to be any security. I just want to point that out. We didn't have to have it. We didn't want it. And everything was pretty good. You know, it wasn't that bad without security. So I'm frankly against the national security movement. I really don't want it. I'm a responsible person. I'm not going to do anything weird. I just want to find my seat and sit down. So
people used to,
if we can make shows, make that barrier less aggressive, you know, the barrier between the control freaks and the audience, less of a hurdle, I think everybody would be so much happier.
Absolutely.
And what's going on in the streets, you know, I understand the anxiety and the, you know, sort of the pain that people are going through with it. And I just hope that they can find somebody to be the voice. Like, I don't know if you guys have ever listened to what Mario Savio did during the Berkeley riots. He was the voice of the Berkeley riots. And he was a guy that just somehow could bring it all together in a speech. Hmm. And just people would just calm down, just zoom, and they would be listening to this. And then and he would deliver. He delivered incredible content in a very short period of time. And you can actually listen to some of his speeches at the University of California at Pomona, has it on their on their archive, their library archive, and you can just go online and listen to him.
How do you spell his last name?
S-A-V-I-O. Mario Savio.
Mario Savio.
Yeah, because then it was very political. You know, it's, oh, geez. But the riots were real, and they were big, and they were really angry, and a lot of people got hurt. And he was kind of like, he was able to help all that get sorted out. But I just don't want anybody to be out in the streets getting hurt. It just, it bothers me as a mother and as a citizen. And I wish this stuff could be resolved with speech making and conversation.
You know, just deep
conversations and panel discussions and whatever.
And the Comes a Time podcast with Mike and O'Teal.
Yes, right? This podcast is part of the solution.
That's what we want to get to
because, you know, go ahead.
Do you think this is a revolution, O'Teal?
Oh, absolutely. Okay. And, you know, part of it what's his name? George Walker said something in a panel that I was watching you on with him and Kim Babbs and Zane. And he said, you know, back then, there was a wave that rose up and we were there when it happened. And he talked about the whole comparing it to sets of waves for surfing. And there's smaller sets and you wait for the big set. And then there's little waves in the big set, but you're waiting for the big wave on the big set. He's like, that's where we were and we rode it. And he said there was a catalyst that galvanized the whole thing, which was Kennedy's assassination.
Oh boy.
And then he said something that blew me away. He goes, I feel there's another wave coming, but I don't know what the catalyst is going to be to galvanize the next thing. And this was before the pandemic happened.
Yeah.
He totally called it. And that's when I realized, I was like, we're at this wave, and it's like the name of our podcast, Comes a Time.
Yeah.
It's here, and so it's not going to go away. That's what it taught me. Like, the wave's not going to go until the wave plays out, and this is a big one.
It is a really big one.
You know, the Mario Savios and, like, James Brown used to do this back when the riots were up. Like, he could calm the black community down, like, where he was at in that city. Mm-hmm. He could
make
people just, he'd be like, hey, calm down. So there's some, you know, I feel like there's always people taking advantage of a peaceful protest. So we get locked into a place where it's like, oh, so I can't peacefully protest now because violence might break out from a low life that just wants to use the crowd do something, or an agent provocateur. Mm-hmm. That wants to pretend to
be a plant. Yes.
Yeah. You know what I mean? So it's like, but what about us that are just peacefully protesting? Like, I can't stop because that's what seems to make change more than this incremental thing, which I feel like we're out of time for it. Like, the Arctic is 100 degrees and you know, you're like talking about incremental change. I'm like, dude, we don't have time for that anymore. Like, we gotta drive this into the end zone. So that's my particular thing. Like, I don't want to tell people what to do, but I also want to help them learn about what happened before. And so we know how it's different now and how we can move into the future and do it peacefully as much as we can, but get that change. Like, I don't know that pulling out of the streets is the way to do it because all these things happen.
Yeah.
When we stay in the streets, you know, but I'm scared. I've got nephews that are out there and they're like, I got some kind of mask, not a gas mask, but then I got this thing that will for something they wear. So if you get hit by the rubber bullets, and I'm just like,
oh. It's horrible. It's absolutely horrible. You know,
and they're in Charlotte, North Carolina, and I'm just terrified. You know,
I was sitting at home watching the DC when Trump tear gassed the crowd to make that walk to the church. And I have, you know, the DC Improv is a legendary comedy club in Washington, DC, and the entire staff and the managers and everyone are like family to me. And I'm at home and I'm like in tears and I'm calling them and texting them. And I'm like, please let me know you're safe. Please let me know that you're okay. And it's, I feel like I can't, you know, my wife's in healthcare. She's a nurse in ICU and we can't, like, I don't want to, you know, I have to stay I can't leave her because if she gets COVID, then, and I'm just like praying that, like, just please send me a message and let me know that you guys are okay, you know? And they finally did. And it's just, so we're all feeling that, like, kind of, you know, what, how do we do this? How do we do this safely and appropriately and properly, but also make an impact? And it's, you know,
I think I've kind of resigned myself to wait to the fact that there's not really a way to do it safely. Yeah. Like, they're not going to let, the authorities aren't going to let us do it safely. And maybe human nature in general, like the low life that wants to loot.
Right. To screw things up for everybody. That guy.
Yeah.
There's always one of those. Yeah.
Oh, wait. At every scene, but right?
More that guy was in the parking lot. Mario Savio's and James Brown would be like, hey, calling those people out, you know, so maybe we'd step up and do that. I don't know, you know.
But, you know, street theater, you know, the old thing of going out, you know, everybody wearing a mask or everybody in a white robe or, you know, whatever your theatrical vision is for getting your point across without getting your head broken in. Yeah. It's important to come up with some gimmicks here, you know. I feel like people are just hurling themselves into the jaws of doom, and I don't want them to do that. I don't want anybody to get hurt. It's completely,
yeah.
It's really a shame.
It's like we're going up against about 1,000 RoboCops too. When you see these videos of cops are in full, you know,
full gear,
NFL gear, hockey gear. I mean.
Or in Portland, like where you're at, like the unmarked troops.
Yeah.
That's super scary. It's like, wow, I don't know if you're like a white supremacist pretending to be.
You have no idea who these people are. Yeah.
You're not. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Let's get off that subject.
Carol, cause MG.
Yes, dear.
I would like to ask you, and, you know, first off, thank you so much for, like, hanging with us, and we need to do this again. But comes a time, Oteil and I sat and thought about what's the name of this podcast and what lyrics or what song or what sticks out, you know, and there's so many poignant Grateful Dead, Hunter, Barlow, lyrics and song names and titles, and Oteil, middle of the night, dude, comes a time. And we started to think about the lyrics and the chorus. It's absolutely perfect to what this is. And what I wanted to ask you, when you go back or when you're listening to, you know, in the Grateful Dead lexicon of tunes, do you have any favorites that will bring a smile to your face? I know you're going to say all of them, but like,
no,
for instance,
not all of them. Stella Blue
and
Chris. That doesn't bring a smile. That Stella Blue is a sad song to me. Yeah. It's a weeper. But Comes a Time is a wonderful tune, and I think it's very apropos for today. But I'm trying to think. You know, Jerry wrote a tune for the band way back at the beginning, which they never play anymore, or they only played it a few times, called Cream Puff War.
Yeah.
And I loved that song, and I could never figure out why they didn't use it more. But if we could just all get out there and throw cream puffs at each other, maybe things instead of bullets and angry words, it would be better.
I love it.
Wavy gravy for president.
Exactly. Nobody for president.
Nobody for president.
That's what
everybody for president.
Yeah. Yeah. Well,
thank you.
So thank you, you guys. This is interesting. And I hope it all goes well, Oteil.
Thank you.
I'm really pleased. And of course, I'm going to tell you your business by saying, get a headset like this so you don't have this microphone in front of your face. they're bad. And you can get headsets with teeny weeny little earphones. And they
have one somewhere. I even have like a noise canceling one somewhere.
Yeah.
This is good.
Safe. Very organized. Thank you so much for organizing this for us.
Absolutely.
And I really appreciate being able to blah, blah, blah with you folks on a very hot day in Oregon and I really could be out there watering my tomatoes, but I can do that later.
You could do that later. You're watering our tomato.
Yes, so, my tomato's getting watered.
We
and thank you for sharing all those lovely stories about Ken.
I'll definitely send you via. I'll get your email or whatever. I could send you an audio link to listen to the. And I'll send you a couple pictures of the pictures that I have from being there. So
thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yeah.